morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Mike's sitting across from me. He told me that he's got some crazy stuff that we're going to have to beat up on him and quiet him down.
Well, Mike Cosentino here and Gary LeMaster over there and Steve. And for some godforsaken reason, we're going to talk about the Donald this morning, the Trumpster, the fascist that is the leader of the Republican Party. I mean, I don't know where to stop. I have quotes this morning from Facebook, just fresh this morning, from people that think Trump is going to save the world.
I think, yeah. And I think that what I want to talk about, too, Mike, is the Republican Party that Trump's pretty much sees the machinery of and the voters of, and how the Republican Party set itself up for this. I mean, I know that Democrats and many independents are really unsympathetic to see the Republicans in this kind of Trump trouble.
Right.
But on the other hand, how did this happen?
It is beautiful, because if you Google it or Yahoo it or whatever, you see all these stories from January, February, March, April about how the GOP had these secret plans, how the Republicans had secret plans to stop Trump, or obvious plans, or what part of the RNC or the Republican establishment was going to stop Trump. You know, and of course, now in May and June, you see all these headlines, just as a complete shift. Can Trump unite the Republican Party? Can Trump... is the nominee going to go all the way and say the right things at the convention? So it's the corporate media, the Republican media has this is it, man.
So Trump hasn't.
This is who the nominee is.
From the point of view of a right wing or conservative ideological guy, a Republican, the Wall Street Journal, and all these people. Trump is not saying the right things. He's saying some of the right things and some of the wrong things. How did he take over the party, Mike?
So how did the party come up with a fascist as its leader?
What I would say is this. If you build, you know, your house of cards, yeah, it's easy to blow it over. So Gary has cataloged the lies of the Republican Party. So for several decades, the Republican Party has built up a whole series of nonsensical lies, like supply side economics. Oh, we can cut taxes and everything will be fine.
Right.
Give the rich more money and you'll get more money. Trickle down economics.
Social Security doesn't work.
All we have to do is
Medicare
go kick ass in the international affairs. And everything will just be fine. All of these lies, misunderstandings and stuff. When you build a house based on lies and lack of facts, really. I mean, the facts contradict almost all these predictions, particularly the economic ones. It's now clear in 2016 that all the supply-side stuff didn't make much sense. It didn't work, never has worked. But the Republican Party built its house on these false assumptions.
Don't forget the strategy that allowed Trump's racism to take the forefront.
Right.
The so-called Southern strategy.
Why don't you guys talk about that? When did that start?
The Huffington Post, I want to get this in. The Huffington Post has done the stats, and Trump lies every 188 words.
Okay. Why don't his supporters care?
It's
because they've been fed lies for the last two or three four decades, and so having more lies is not particularly interest them one way or the other. Other thing is that they didn't care, and this is the thing I wanted to talk about, guys, and then you guys hand it over to you. But the thing I saw was that the Republicans profess values in balanced budget, they claim, which would, you know, nobody has a balanced budget. Deficit reduction, free trade, all of these things. Trump goes all over the place. And Trump's, what I would say about this is Trump's appeal is to the real drivers of the Republican Party, and one of them is just what you guys broke up, brought up, which is racial resentment. I mean, that's economic resentment. And the racial resentment hits a lot of different ways. And so I think that's the thing that's driving it. If you look at Trump, he's not really gone against Republican values. He's gone against Republicans' professed values, particularly by their conservative right-wing ideologues. Because he's kind of – he follows whatever will drive anger and stuff the most. So, you know, so he doubles down on being anti-Muslim. He doubles down on being anti-Mexican. These are the real drivers of a lot of the Republican Party resentment. And that's why he seems to not obey their rule. The rule is, first, he's not obeying the rules of propriety, right, Gary?
Well, I think you have to look at the coalition that the Republicans built over a long period of time, going back to the 70s after the late 60s after the civil rights movement. They decided to capitalize intentionally. I mentioned the Southern strategy. They intentionally decided to capitalize on the Southern unhappiness with desegregation, and so they brought over the Southern Democrats or the Dixiecrats into their coalition. They then pandered to the evangelical right.
Let me give you an example. In I think it was 1984, Ronald Reagan went to the county in Mississippi, the most racist county in Mississippi, where the three civil rights workers were killed, and gave a speech about states' rights. Right, Gary? Mm-hmm. This is what we're talking about.
So this is, you know, he embraced, or the party embraced the racists across the South, and they embraced the people that believe any other religion than Christianity is a false religion. So, you know, it really has come
forward. Is it identity politics? I mean, it's my religion, Christianity, and I can't respect Judaism or Islam or Buddhism. It's my religion, or my religion is right, my race is right, my economic status is right, my part of the country is right. I mean, there's this kind of, you call it nationalism, but it's really not even about nationalism, it's a kind of driver. So some of us see, like, Obama. Let's give you one example, Gary. See Obama getting elected president. He's the first black man to ever be elected president of the United States. And a lot of us white guys are thinking, hey, great, good. I mean, it's about time. And he's
post-racial America.
Yeah.
He's around the corner.
He's talented. He's a good guy. He's smart and all that. And it's great that we have a black president. Other guys see a black president, say, well, I'm a white guy and he's a black guy. I'm a white guy, he's a black guy. I don't even have to have a theory about blacks being inferior or more successful or anything else. I just have to have them and us.
It's a
what's
fear,
good for black guys is not good for white
fear,
guys.
Fear of the other. I think another thing that we can't leave out with this whole discussion of why Trump, you know, has taken the nomination or will.
Well, why? We want to examine the party. But go ahead. Say what you're going to say.
I think you can't forget that, you know, a study recently proved that people on the right, especially the extreme right, only consume media that restates their own ideas. They don't look beyond that. They're such committed viewers of Fox News Channel and you know, Rush Limbaugh, et cetera, that they refuse to even listen or debate somebody who has ideas different than
Let
them.
Let me put a question to the two of you, particularly to Mike. Yeah. The last two Republican nominees for president were Republican establishment nominees, right?
Right.
Romney, McCain, both, you know, like have the stamp of approval by the Republican establishment.
Got it.
This time, and everyone said, well, you know, in the end, all those crazy guys, in the end, Romney came out on top. So the money will win out this time, and it's probably going to be Jeb Bush or his acolyte, you know, Rubio or something like that. Why didn't it happen this time?
Yeah. Steve, I'm really, you know, usually I rise to all of your challenges here, and I don't know that I can explain it. You guys have been doing the disaffected white guy thing, but I don't know if that's enough to explain it. You've talked about it, and I think that it has all of these things contribute. You talked about a party that was that has fostered lies for so long that now that they have this.
A better liar comes along and they're done, right?
Well, not even a really good liar, but a constant liar, a man that doesn't realize his own lies, and a media that doesn't call it. Trump's the story, so he got all that free advertising. A lot of people blame the media, and I think that is a big part of it. In other words, you could take the stapler and give it the coverage that Donald Trump got, and it would be a viable candidate for president, and quite frankly, a better one. That's really, really important. And the parties being what they are, both of them, but in this case, the Republicans, once that momentum starts, they know how it works, and it works so well. Once again, this stapler with the momentum that Trump had going through the spring. Don't forget all those stories, Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, on who's going to stop Trump, stop Trump. They all had these plans to stop him.
But they couldn't, right?
And they couldn't.
This time they had a guy running in the race who wasn't a Santorum that they could stop.
Well, the other thing,
or a Huckabee they could stop.
Right.
It was a Donald Trump who they couldn't figure out a way to stop.
The other thing they didn't count on, I think, Gary and Steve, before we... You tell us the truth, Gary, and then the truth and the light, is that the primary process being as it is, you know, Trump didn't get a hell of a lot of votes. The caucus system, 21 states still do caucuses? Somewhere
sounds
between
about
eight
Mike.
And 21.
Sounds about right.
A lot of states still do caucuses. I mean, you go stand in a corner with this was like in grammar school. You know, so we're talking about a relatively small number of votes. I think up until... recently, Ted Cruz had more Republicans vote for him during the primary than Donald Trump. Donald Trump just won more.
So part of its personality.
Primaries.
I mean, Cruz was such a nasty personality.
I don't want to talk about Cruz. That's not it. But I'm just talking about who got more votes. In other words, who's really got support? Nate Silver came out the other day and said even Hillary wins in a landslide. Nate Silver, the guy who's got it right all these times, because just as we know sitting around this table, and just as they know down at the Sundowner, and just as they know at the country clubs that Tom Tabak goes to, they know that Trump can't be elected in America.
Can I venture as a former ad guy? I'd like to venture something that is a truism in the advertising marketing business is that emotions matter more than facts, and Trump understands that far better than any other political candidate I've seen. That's why he can lie, you know, so prodigiously and not pay a penalty for it. It's because his supporters don't care if he's telling the truth or not. They only emotionally attach to the guy.
See, I told you, truth on the light.
The other thing I, before we go off on something else, is that I'd like to point out is the incredible greed of the corporate media. As best described by Moonves, the chair and CEO of CBS, who stated on numerous occasions to his own affiliates that Trump is a gold mine. He's going to make us millions and billions of dollars because he drives ratings. Okay. So the media all pandered to Trump. And now I predict that once he gets the nomination, the media will then start to try to rip him apart, because they then can turn around and say, look, right, we're telling the truth, but they created this monster to begin with.
They may try to normalize him. What you see is talking about the Republican Party. You see is the real lack of principle in the Republican Party, because in the end, even guys like Paul Ryan If you notice the pattern, folks, of the people in the Republican Party who endorse Trump and those that haven't, the guys like Romney who are not planning to run again, or Jeb Bush, haven't endorsed him. The guys who are planning to run again, like Paul Ryan and all of the rest of that crew, they've all endorsed him because they don't want to face a primary where your opponent says, you did not support our presidential candidate, the very, very popular among extremely right-wing folks,
and that's
Donald Trump.
That's
what they're afraid of.
That's why he didn't win. And that's, you're right. If the arc of the campaign is long enough, then what Gary just said as far as the media turning on him, or at least his lies will become the story. His lack of qualifications will become the story.
His indictments
will become the story. And if the, like I said, if the arc of the campaign is long enough, then all that will come out, and he loses, and he loses all credibility. And possibly, if all this happens before August, he doesn't even get the nomination. And then we have a really interesting race. I mean, all of this stuff about having the presumptive nominee months and months, even a year before the convention, is not healthy. Both parties do this.
I think our whole campaign system of these huge, long, extraordinarily expensive campaign system is really out of control.
Well,
that's another issue to talk about.
Public financing of campaigns.
The financing is out of control. The length of the campaign, the media coverage that's almost, as you guys are saying, focused on whoever says the most outrageous things. And the thing about Donald Trump is he knows how to play this. I'll build a wall, and anyone upset, and I'll make the Mexicans pay for it.
He can't explain.
You know, I mean, it's the kind of stuff you see in a bar when two guys are, you know, going at it with some kind of, you know, verbal pyro. They don't really care so much who wins. They're just doubling. But then he's turned it into a policy.
I'd like to point out another culprit in this whole affair, and that's the public in general. And what I mean by that is you know, the indifference people have to politics and the short attention spans. I don't have time to look up what this guy stands for. I don't have time to do this. I don't have time to do that. They'll spend more time analyzing which vehicle to buy or which packaged food at the store. They'll spend more time analyzing that than they will analyzing the platform of an individual candidate.
And then you have 158 families in the United States that contribute most of the money in politics.
Mm-hmm.
You have this tiny, tiny 0.1% who are providing all the money. And you have other people not paying attention. Or if you can make politics, I guess, nasty enough, then people will go, oh, I don't even want to, you know, I don't even want to think about that.
Well,
I don't want to go there. I'm going to go fishing.
That's the old Paul Wyrick, you know, one of the strategists for the GOP in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. That was, you know, one of his strategies that they still embrace is if we can turn enough people off to the whole political process, make them think the whole process and government is corrupt,
right. Then
they won't vote, and our zealots will turn out in force, and we'll win.
And then you accompany it with voter suppression, right, Mike?
Right, exactly. And right, between those two, the more they can make you mad, the less you're likely to vote, the more they can run things. But the George Will talks about a book that somebody called The Cult of the Presidency, and it talks about how, and especially the kind of, I think, Trump supporters we're talking about, is that they have all of this magical thinking and wonderment attached to the office, you know, attached to executive power, as if it...
Power in general, I think.
But
I mean, what Trump exudes is success and a power, a kind of narcissistic obsession with his own power and success.
Well,
and that makes you feel less anxious. It's the guy on the white horse, Mike.
Exactly.
It's the guy on the white horse.
Exactly.
You're anxious. The guy in the white horse, he's Napoleon, he's Donald Trump, he's whoever, he's going to say thing, and you identify with this arrogant.
Which of course the presidency
blankety
is
blank.
Not. That's why they call it, the book is called The Cult of the Presidency. It has nothing to do with reality.
So they call this in psychology narcissistic fantasy and defense against anxiety. And it's affected mostly traditional Christian white males, which is like us. And when I was growing up, whether you believe the stuff or not, I never believed that women were stupid and shouldn't have jobs. And when I studied physics, you know, we'd have 40 guys in a classroom and two women, you know. I thought this is really bizarre because they can do it as well as we can. We still had privileges. We assumed that white males would run things like they'd always run things in the United States. And as a white male, you were kind of one up on other people. And even if you were generously hearted, that was the assumption of the society, that other people would end up in lower levels, in the same way you assume that that for the most part, the people who were wealthiest were going to end up on the top.
Can I do a couple of Trump quotes?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Trumpisms.
We want to talk about that. We want to make sure that people understand, because, you know, how these things get lives of their own, and then people never hear the original quote. He said that he testified to the excellence of his penis, on national media. My fingers are long.
We needed to know that.
Well, I'm sorry. My fingers are long and beautiful, as has been well documented, are various other parts of my body, is what he said. That his masculine, he boasts about his conquests with women, often seemingly very happily married, and that he's been able to date or screw. Or that he says, it doesn't really matter what the media writes, as long as you got a young, beautiful piece of ass. I think these are the golden quotes from Donald Trump.
Well, he said some other things like they asked him.
I'm starting to turn around here. I'm starting to
convinced
like
you.
I'm starting to like this guy.
They asked him, "Is the best company in the world for you yourself?" No, and Trump said, "No, the best company in the world for me is a good piece of ass."
All right. Well, there you go.
I mean, this is an actual quote. This somebody is, who vaguely trying to understand the guy.
This is why I read an article this morning that I don't remember the organization. I think it was the Academy of Clinical Psychiatrists or Psychologists, but one of the academic organizations of psychiatrists and psychologists, for the first time ever, has inserted itself in the presidential race by, analyzing a candidate. And they have, talked about how they no longer have to hire an actor to do a film to display narcissistic tendencies. All they have to do is show Trump videos. He is the classic narcissist who builds himself up by tearing others down.
Yes, by tearing others down. He's very, very, very good at it. He's been doing it for a long time. He's made a profession of it, sort of. And I think that's... it's the identification with that. So some people look at Trump and they identify with that personality, with the triumphantness of the personality. I'm a winner, you're losers. That kind of, for Trump, the entire world is a matter of winners and losers. Losers are weak. They're not unlucky. They're weak and they're stupid. And winners are powerful and smart. And he's powerful and smart. And if you identify with him, you're going to have a powerful, smart guy who can get things done.
I think that explains social media's support of him. And that's very good. But I do want to go back to the George Will Washington Post article that talks about that so far. Only 4.7% of the America's eligible voters had supported Trump, because we're talking about a party that only represents 33% of the population in the primary.
But Mike, he has 6.7 Twitter followers
in a process that only 33% of the electorate. So he talked about independence. Romney had to get 5% of independence, even if everybody in the Republican Party voted for him. And Trump is going to need way beyond that. Mm-hmm. And even in states that voted red in 2000, according to George Will, 60 62% view Trump unfavorably.
Okay, so the Republican Party, by this creating this house of misinformation,
right,
from supply economics to all we have to do is be more aggressive in the world, intervene more, and everything.
And unregulate banks.
Unregulate everything. All we have to do is
privatize
everything. All we have to do is get more money to the rich people, and everything is going to be super
fine.
Take
federal lands.
They built this house of cards. And Trump came in and kind of took it over.
Yep.
I'd like to point out that this may be, this may be off topic slightly, but this may be the first presidential nominee who is indicted before the election. If you start looking into Trump University and what's going on with that, and now they're investigating the apparent bribery of Greg Abbott when he was attorney general in Texas and the bribery of the attorney general of Florida, you actually might see indictments come down against Trump personally before even the convention.
But would that even lessen his support? Let's go back to what Gary was talking about earlier, Mike. And Gary is saying, and you were saying, both of you were saying, Trump doesn't have a much of a chance, according to Nate Silver and all these predictable guys. Nate Silver was originally a sports guy.
I think we should all be very nervous,
okay,
even with that.
What happens if Trump loses colossally to the Republican Party? Will they learn anything? Will they change anything about what they're doing?
No, it's worked too well.
They look what happened after the 2012 election, where they had the autopsy of the Republican Party, and they pointed out that they were not performing well, getting votes from blacks and from Latinos and women, and so they were going to make a concerted effort to try to enlarge the tent and bring these people in, and instead they've further alienated them.
And they did voter suppression. It was easier to do voter suppression
and gerrymandering
and gerrymandering than it was to do what you're talking about, actually outreach. I think there's so much insecurity among their core voters. And we were talking about this before the show, folks, and I was asking Gary and Mike what they think about it. But when I hear the anti-immigrant stuff, the anti-Mexican stuff, I very seldom hear that they're coming to take our jobs, because particularly when you live in the Southwest, that seems like not true. And also, the more people you have, the more economic goodies go around. But go ahead, Mike.
But it is true. When they drive, even though it's not true, it seems true. When you drive by a public building in Cottonwood or Sedona or Flagstaff, and you see a completely Latino crew, then you have people in their Crown Victorias saying those Americans should be working those jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about the ridiculous anecdote, and it has nothing to do with facts or figures or anything else. But now they've seen it, you know, with personal observation. So, which is...
So you think it is a lot of...
Well, I mean, it's an American company, and every one of those people may have been before
generation
Americans.
But I don't hear that in the anti-immigrant rhetoric. What I hear is...
No, you can't.
The border is out of control. We cannot control the border. There's this huge level of frustration. There's all these people that we don't know in the country, because we actually do know them, because, like you say, they're the guys who are cleaning.
Yeah, same guys.
But... there's what I see is a frustration of people over the inability to do what they want to do. In other words, they want to close the border, they can't.
Now, let's think about the Republican Party's failure to, as leaders in the House, to have any kind of jobs thing. Any jobs thing. We're talking 8 years of no jobs bill, no jobs help. And so
you just give the rich more money, Mike, and then the jobs will their job creators.
I'm trying to answer the frustration comes from a lot of poverty. There's a lot of poverty in this valley, folks.
How about any form of immigration bill? in those 8 years.
Okay.
Zero.
Just a stinking jobs bill.
I mean, if they're
fine.
So concerned about the borders, wouldn't you think they'd make that a priority?
Just helping people survive, raising the minimum wage, which they fight against tooth and nail, which I will never understand.
Oh, but because if you raise the minimum wage, it will cut the number of jobs.
That's always going to be jobs, Mike.
Well, and there's no, once again, there's no data.
You can't have conservation because that'll cut jobs. You have to have drilling on the national forest because otherwise you'll have jobs.
Richard Branson was on TV the other day talking about how by 2050 it's all going to be fine because the economy is going to drive conservation. The jobs are going to be, I mean, we have all this argument now by what he considers, maniacs that are so incredibly wrong, and the arc of time, once again, it's my favorite phrase this morning, is going to prove them wrong. And by 2050, you're going to have hundreds of thousands of green energy jobs because that's where the money, that's where the intelligence.
But
that's
going to be chaos before that happens, right?
And we're in the chaos now.
Along those lines, when you hear people talk about, the Republicans talk about global warming and how it'll cause jobs and how it'll cause all these problems, if we try to address it, and they continually put down the solar industry. I was reading an article last night that the nation of Chile has committed so much to solar power that they have too much energy. Electricity, and they're giving it away free. It's because they've so committed to renewable energy. If you look at the reality of all these arguments, the minimum wage, every study that you find shows that if you increase the minimum wage, it benefits the economy, and it creates jobs.
I'm a coal miner though.
Yeah.
And I'm being put out of work,
right,
either by environmental regulations,
right,
which the conservatives are telling me,
and that's what I mean,
or by
the
cheap gas.
But that's what I mean by the jobs bill. The retraining for every one of those coal miners has got to be in any jobs bill.
Because even though it's the right direction for the country, for individual pockets of people, it's not much fun if you're in the wrong industry at the wrong time.
Absolutely true.
It's like working, if I've done before, both successful companies. It's a lot more fun to work in a successful company that's making money than one that's losing money and in trouble.
I had a guy from Wales.
For everybody.
I had a guy from Wales staying with me 10 years ago, 10 years ago. And he was a mechanic. He hurt his back. He got retrained as a psychologist. It was just something he always wanted to do. He had the head for it. So in his 50s, he became a – so I'm just talking about when a industry or a profession or whatever you want to call it, a job becomes – and this is happening so much right now because of technology – it gets pushed to the side, then yeah, that's the purpose of government. That's why we want government. This is what government should do. This is a function of government. Take that guy, take that woman, retrain them, give them some training, and send them out there for another job.
This sort of disruption is inherent in any economy, and it's always going to happen. It's happened in my former industry, the ad business.
Absolutely.
Where a lot of very talented and well-paid people have been displaced by the social media and by some client's nephew or niece who is good with computers.
Right.
If you worked in the internet in the early days, you were making pretty good money. I had a small company in New York doing a lot of freelance stuff, and you're making pretty good money. And suddenly, the damn junior colleges train people in writing HTML, and suddenly everybody's got an uncle or a niece or a nephew or a son that can do your job for a lot less.
On one hand, we hold up these industries that we call the current term is disruptive, that we're going to have disruption.
There is going to be disruption, though, Gary.
Always. But we've now lionized these industries as saying, look at Uber. That's great. Look at what it's done. It's torn apart the cab industry and the unions. And so we look at all of these new types of industry and hold them up as being great on one hand. And then on the other hand, we decry the fact that it's displaced the people that were earning a good wage, and now they're having to be retrained or having to find other work, or they just settled for less.
But isn't Mike right? The best thing that government can do is first provide a safety net, because you're being put out of work by social forces. You're a coal miner; gas is much cheaper. People don't want to build coal-fired plants anymore because it's more expensive. It's got a lot of pollution.
Where's the money going to come from? I'll tell you where the money is going to come from. And here's where we earn our name this morning, Democratic perspective.
Where are you going to get the money, Mike? To retrain people, because there is disruption.
Cut the defense budget by 85%, and we'd still have the largest defense budget in the world, number one. Number two, my favorite financial transaction tax, half a cent, first year raises $137 billion. Everybody, we're talking about the Robin Hood tax is what it's been dubbed, and I'm not sure I'm crazy about that name, but boy, that seems to be, in America especially, the most popular. So between the Robin Hood tax and we're talking 55% of your tax dollar goes for defense.
I think just higher taxes on the wealthy. I mean, what's happening is not just in the United States, although it's worse in the United States than most developed countries, is that the upper echelon of economic earners have quintupled. Is that the right word? Quintupled the amount of money they made.
Quintupled.
Quintupled the amount of money they made. While incomes for middle class and working class people have been stagnant, not only in the United States, but much of the rest of the world. But it's particularly bad here. And I think that's the economic background for someone like Trump, because you have this economic stagnation. You have social change, particularly if you're a white male. You're not at the top necessarily anymore.
Well,
there's women. You have a woman boss. I've worked for women.
There's no such thing as a high-wage middle-class job. Well, I want to say no such thing, but they're much harder to find. High-wage middle-class jobs that the kind of population you're talking about used to count on. That, you know, that I don't need to have special training. I don't need a government training program. I don't need college. I just need to be willing to work and work hard and show up on time. And I'll make a living wage. And I'll be able to have a car.
And middle and working class white males in the United States have a higher death rate. Everybody else's death rate's going down, right, Gary? But in the United States, the death rate of middle aged white males from drugs, from suicide, from a lot of different factors, bad health, things like smoking, has actually increased.
I would point out that all of the things that you guys are talking about are the very things that the anger and frustration and disappointment that Trump has tapped into. He is, that's the emotion that's driving the supporters of him. And the problem is that these people have misplaced their anger. They've directed it towards the government. Right. All of these issues are not government driven. They're corporate driven. The reason that good high paying jobs in manufacturing have left the country is for two reasons. One is it's cheaper labor in Vietnam and China than it is in the U.S., and they can get around unions.
What Gary's referring to is that first the jobs go to Mexico, and then China is cheaper than Mexico, and then Vietnam is cheaper than China.
Sri Lanka, et cetera. It's a race to the bottom. And the other part of that is, they're working madly because of this $15 minimum wage. The people like McDonald's, the CEOs of companies like that, are working madly to create robotics that will flip burgers so they don't have to pay anybody. for that. So the anger
that was going to happen anyway.
Absolutely.
Everybody knows
that has nothing to do
with going to hit.
That has nothing to do with the minimum wage. It is more about the race to the bottom, the way to find the cheapest way to make something.
What do you do about it? Suppose. Well, let's not get too futuristic, which is artificial intelligence taking over a lot of jobs. They're going to drive your car. They're going to sweep your floor. They're going to do all this stuff. And so there won't be people needed. There was one burst of automation that actually brought more jobs, right? The original when they started making Ford cars on an assembly line. That actually created jobs. But the new automation looks like it'll decrease jobs. And what do you do about that, Mike? I mean, is there a social program that will help that?
Well, yes, of course. Well, there is a whole untapped source of jobs. And as Branson said, green energy. We're ignoring it rather than embracing it because there's millions of jobs there.
And they're high-paying jobs. And the other thing that we're ignoring, at least the Republicans are ignoring, is infrastructure. If we want to create a lot of high-paying jobs and a lot of hard-hat jobs, the kind of things that people are regretting having lost, we need to start rebuilding bridges and highways.
I'm a conservative Republican. Why don't I want to do that? Why don't I want deep green jobs? Why don't I want to spend money on infrastructure?
We don't know that in this room, Steve. We're talking about a win-win situation. You get a safe bridge. You get a better road.
But I don't want to do that because that's taxes. I'll have to pay more taxes to have decent highways.
It causes the wealthy and the corporations to pay more taxes.
So where are you going to get the money, guys? Where are you going to get the money to build all these bridges
and
stuff?
The wealthy and the corporations, not from our little theater major down here at the hub in Sedona.
The fallacy of all this is when you create, good paying jobs, like construction jobs and green energy jobs, you collect more taxes from the people that are filling those jobs.
Yeah, we didn't invent this stuff. I mean, other countries have been doing this for a long time. That's right.
Switzerland just opened the longest and deepest tunnel in the world to connect themselves better to the rest of Europe.
I've said before, the World War II style, I was in the Vietnam era GI Bill where I didn't have to put anything in. It costs, I don't know, $200 million. They've gotten back hundreds of billions of dollars from people like me. Rather than driving the gas truck in Buffalo, that was my dream job. You know, I've made hundreds of thousands of dollars more as I was trained to do with the GI Bill. My story has been repeated tens of millions of times throughout. So a small investment in a GI Bill post-Vietnam, post-World War II, did exactly what Gary said. It provided more tax dollars for the government to do other things.
The other really stupid aspect of this is that we are in a time when we have the lowest interest rates in our history. And so if we want to do infrastructure and green energy with government funds, there is no better time and has been no better time than to borrow that money to create these jobs and raise our revenues and solve problems at the same time.
I was going to say somebody has a birthday today. Gary, it's your birthday. Happy birthday.
I just turned 30, yeah.
Yeah, you did turn 30. He looks like a 30-year-old. He looks like Charles de Gaulle
I'm the first person since Jack Benny to collect Social Security at 30.
Yeah, there's all kinds of scams, Gary. Let's not give yours away.
Yeah, that's right.
I want to point out a couple of things from our relative to our sponsors. We're sponsored in part by Democrats of the Red Rocks, and they have a breakfast coming up on Thursday, June 16th, and featuring Harriet Young, who is one of my favorite people to talk about.
Who was on our show last month.
Right. And then for those of for my friend Michael Weiser is speaking this Thursday at 5:30 in Prescott with the Democrats of Yavapai County.
So. And the door office will be open this month soon.
Yeah, please go by the door office and find out who to vote for. Remember, you want Bill Mundell and Tom Chabon for Arizona Corporation Commission. We'll give you the candidates that will get Arizona out of the mess that we're in.
Tom O'Halloran for Congress and Ann Kirkpatrick for the Senate.
And so on and so forth. Absolutely.
You can hear this show
on. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Mike. I will. You're the expert.
I'm the expert. That's right.
You've only got 10 seconds. You can go ahead.
This podcast and other podcasts of all our wonderful shows. And you can follow my link on Facebook to Democratic Perspective website, which is vvid.org. vvid.org, and catch this show and all our wonderful shows. Thank you.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.